John chapter 11, you're welcome to follow along if you have a Bible. If you want to follow along in the Bible in front, it's the black book in front of you. It's page 897. And if all else fails, just Google John chapter 11 on your smartphone and this passage will come right up. This morning we're talking about the resurrection of Lazarus, a fantastic story of Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead, a small picture of what he will do someday. I think I've said this before about this passage. When Jesus says, "Lazarus, come forth," there's an old pastor by the name of Charles Spurgeon from London who said, if Jesus did not signify, "Lazarus, come forth," if he just said, "Come forth," all the graves would have opened. What happens with Lazarus here is unique to Lazarus. Someday Jesus will call us forth. So the story of the death of Lazarus, let me just walk through a couple points before we get into the kind of the nuts and bolts of the message this morning. We have three characters. We have Lazarus who dies, Mary and Martha. And Mary and Martha send word to Jesus while Lazarus is still sick. And Jesus does two things that are rather strange from our perspective. First of all, he makes this statement. He says, "This sickness is not unto death, but to glorify the Son." Rather unusual thing to say. We'll unpack that in a few minutes. Then he does something that's even stranger. Jesus hears about the sickness of his friend, and the text says he intentionally waited 2 days before he took his journey. Now, why would Jesus intentionally wait before he made his way to minister to this family? Again, we'll return back to that as we get moving. When Jesus enters into the village, by this time, of course, because Jesus waited, his friend has passed away. He's died. He's been buried now for a few days. Mary and Martha, the sisters, come up to Jesus, and they both say the same thing. "Jesus, if you were here, our brother would not be dead." Again, "Martha, if you were here, our brother would still be alive." Jesus walks up to the tomb. The custom was that they would roll these big boulders in front of the tomb. That was often to keep wild animals out. Rich family like this, they'd often bury somebody like Lazarus with some kind of gold or silver, some kind of family heirloom, and those big stones would also keep grave robbers from going in and collecting the goods. And so Jesus calls for that stone to be rolled away. Mary and Martha are under the assumption that Jesus wants to see the body, and that's why Martha says, "Jesus, he's been dead for 4 days, his body stinketh by now." Nevertheless, Jesus says, "Roll away the stone." And he says, "Father, you always hear me, but so that these people may believe, Lazarus, come forth." And Lazarus rises. He walks out of the tomb. He's got the old grave clothes on. And Jesus, and I love this little statement, he says, "Take the grave clothes off and put new clothes on him." Beautiful picture of resurrection life. Now, what do we see in the resurrection of Lazarus? I suggest we see two things, at least two things. We see a family that has experienced extraordinary pain. The kind of pain I think that we can relate to. And we also see extraordinary hope with Jesus in the power of the resurrection. Jesus meets the pain of the family with the power of the resurrection. And that's what I want to do today. I want to talk about three points of pain that the family felt that I'm convinced you and I feel today. And let's talk about how the power of the resurrection meets us in our own pain. You find yourself hurting this morning? Well, let's see how the power of the resurrection can minister to us today. All right, so three points of pain that all of us feel. And we're going to see it here in the life of Lazarus, Mary, and Martha. Number one is this. You got to deal with the pain you have in your own life. Every one of us has to come to grips with the reality that nobody lives forever. At least nobody lives forever in this life, right? We live somewhere forever, but not here in the life that we have right now, not on earth. Everybody has to come to grips with the fact that nobody lives forever. Lazarus is a picture of every one of us. Lazarus doesn't live forever. You and I aren't going to live forever. When the community comes to the funeral and Mary and Martha look at Lazarus, it brings them face to face with this reality that they themselves are not going to live forever. That's something we don't want to talk about. That's something we try to push out of our minds. But when you see somebody like Lazarus and you see the tragedy that he went through, it brings us face to face with this reality. And as unpleasant as it is, all of us are someday going to experience verse 39. "Lord, he's been there 4 days and his body stinketh." That's a reality we all have to face. 5,417 people an hour, 130,000 people a day. almost 50 million people a year. Nobody lives forever. Ralph Waldo Emerson said this, "Tobacco, coffee, hash, strychnine, all weak delusions. The surest poison is time." Emerson's right. You know, if the alcohol and the strychnine doesn't get you, what gets you? Time, every one of us. Hebrews says, "It is appointed unto man to die once." There's an appointment that all of us have, the author says. Solomon in the Old Testament is a really interesting verse where he says, how dies the wise man? Solomon says, like the fool. You know, education ain't going to help you here. How dies the poor man? Like the rich. How dies the Westerner? Like the Easterner. It's universal. I was thinking about this week. Has it ever occurred to you, you have a better chance of landing on the moon than living forever? There's a better chance you're going to hit a home run in Game 7 of a World Series someday than live forever. There's a better chance that you'll win a Connecticut State Lottery 7 times in a row than live forever. Those are the odds. That's pretty powerful odds, isn't it? There's a better chance you'll get struck by lightning and get a superpower than live forever, right? 10 out of 10 people die, right? The reason we're uncomfortable with this kind of passage is it confronts every one of us with our own mortality. Everyone must come to grips with the fact that nobody lives forever. Someday we all fall down. A while back, I was reading about the Great Plague in London, 17th century. They called it the Black Death. Apparently, they called it the Black Death because of the marks it left on the body, as well as the mystery that kind of hung over the cities at the time. In May of 1664, it claimed its first few victims, but it was basically ignored. By that same time the next year, 600 people died in May. The next month, 6,000. In July, 17,000. By August, 31,000. Before the Black Plague was done, it was some 70,000 people. Back then, we're told that some people believed that it was the polluted air that was causing the Black Death. We know today, of course, it was the fleas and the rats and some of the carriers like that. But one story says that the physicians devised a strange ritual to bring about a cure. Since some of them maybe believed it was pollution, they'd scatter some rose petals around. And they'd walk people around the rose petals and let them breathe in the fragrance of the rose petals so they wouldn't be harmed by the pollution in the air. I heard one writer say that some of the doctors would stick rose petals in their pockets when they went to make visits. And as one legend has it, and it's just legend, one man was on his way to the cemetery and he could hear people chanting, "Ring around the rosy, a pocket full of posies, ashes, ashes, we all fall down." You can carry as many rose petals as you want. You can spread them all over the place. He's right. We all fall down. And here in our world today, this is a reality that we don't want to face. We try to do everything to push it off. We spend a lot of money at the end of our lives. We think we're going to live forever. But someday, we all fall down. In our story, before you can get to the hope, we have to face what Mary and Martha are feeling. They're feeling their own mortality, just like everybody that would visit Lazarus there at the funeral. There's that pain of self, but there's an even greater pain in the text. It's the pain of others. And by that I mean this. We struggle with the pain that other people feel. Like Mary and Martha, we feel condemned to sit helpless as those around us that we love experience pain. This really came home to me when I was reading an Australian writer. His name is Leon Morris, and I like reading Leon Morris. He actually wrote a whole book on the book of John, including some on this passage. And Leon Morris, on this passage, makes an interesting observation. He says, there are some people that are fearless. I mean, they'll charge hell with a pitchfork, ride your motorcycle in the rain type people, you know? They don't care if they live, they don't care if they die. He said, but in this passage, you come face to face with everybody's Achilles heel. You yourself may be fearless, but we're all brought to our knees when we think about somebody that we love going through a time of suffering and a time of pain. The pain here is not just about Mary and Martha, that someday they're not going to live forever. They're feeling a pain that their brother is in pain, and their brother is going through a hard time. And so Leon Morris says, every one of us has that fearless attitude, but it comes to an end when we think about the suffering of loved ones, like Lazarus here. You know where this really came home to me? When you think back to action movies of the 80s and 90s, those really corny, diehard kind of action movies, right? You have a guy like Bruce Willis in Die Hard who doesn't care if he lives or dies, right? I mean, a guy walks on glass barefoot. He can handle it. He goes into the elevator with all the fire and walks in, you know? He's such a tough guy. He doesn't care if he lives or dies. But then his wife is threatened, and what happens? all of a sudden he's brought to his knees. That's the Achilles heel that we feel in this passage. Mary and Martha themselves may not fear death. They may not fear pain and suffering in this life. I've met a lot of people like this. I can tell you, as a pastor, you sit down with people in some of the darkest, deepest moments of pain. Some of us are very touched by that. Others, they don't seem to be bothered by much. But everyone is brought to their knees in a somewhat helpless situation. We feel condemned to sit helpless as those around us experience pain. There's a parable in Luke 16. It's a story that Jesus tells about a man that goes to hell. And there he is, and he's suffering. You remember what he says in the passage? He says, let me go back and tell my brothers about this place. He's very concerned about pain that they might endure. There's a man named Jairus that comes to Jesus and cries out that Jesus would heal his daughter. He doesn't care if he lives or dies, but he cares about his daughter. We all have that, don't we? I saw this in my own father's life. My dad was the toughest man I ever met in my life. I hope maybe you say that about your dad. My dad was tough. I never saw my dad cry. Never. He was, you know, not like he's Italian, you know, so he was very sentimental. If you're all sitting together at the dining room table, he might cry, you know, but he never cried over like pain in his life. And I saw my dad go through surgeries and backaches. I saw my dad have a traumatic brain injury, falling off a bike. Fell off a bike at probably about 35, 40 miles an hour. I mean, I saw a lot of pain in my dad's life. I never saw him cry. I saw my dad cry one time. And it wasn't over his own cancer. It's when he looked at me and said, I'm okay. I'm ready to go. I'm worried about your mother. Please take care of your mother. He was not worried about pain in his own life. He was worried about the pain in the life of another. What we are experiencing, John chapter 11, is not that people are worried about their own pain, but they're sitting helpless as they can't help those around them. That's what Mary and Martha feel. But I think there's a third point of pain that kind of mixes in here, and I'm going to tag it as the pain that related to God. We feel this frustration when we ask the question, where is God? And it comes up twice in the text. Martha in verse 21, listen to this. Lord, if you were here, my brother would not have died. Lord, where you been? How about verse 32? Mary herself falls at Jesus' feet saying, Lord, if you'd been here, my brother would not have died. This is a question every one of us asks. When we go through a hard time, when a loved one goes through a hard time, we can't help but ask the question, where is God? Habakkuk asked this question. How long, O Lord, as his village there was about to be invaded by an enemy? David in the Psalms asked this many times. How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? There's this apparent delay of God in bringing justice, isn't there? The Twin Towers fall, and we ask, where is God? Somebody gets in a car accident, where is God? See, there's three points of pain, not just one. The death of Lazarus brings us face to face with, hey, we're not going to live forever in this life. It also leaves us grasping with the pain of trying to watch people work through suffering in their own life. And then we're left wondering, where is God in all this? Three points of pain. But what Jesus does here is absolutely fantastic. Jesus meets them right in their pain in at least four ways. And Jesus meets this family in their pain in four ways. And he meets us in our pain in at least four ways. And I want to give you these four, and this is where we really see the power of Jesus come out. Now, the first thing is this. In Jesus, we see the love of God. God is anything but indifferent. God is anything but careless about how he deals with us and about how he deals with people. Despite the pain that the family feels, and despite the pain that you may feel in your life, regardless of what that pain is, Jesus is the love of God in this passage, and he's the love of God in our lives. Let me share where this comes from in the text. Back to this question of why did Jesus wait? What would cause Jesus, when he hears about the suffering of Lazarus, he's about to die, Jesus says, well, I'm just going to wait 2 days, then I'm going to go. Why would Jesus wait 2 days so Lazarus can die? Well, if we go back to the first century, this is going to help us out. Let's understand the history here. First of all, we have to understand that these funerals were massive, and I mean massive, much bigger than the funerals we have today. People would come from miles and miles around, even if they did not know the person that died, and that would especially be true for a rich man like Lazarus. Lazarus here obviously has a lot of money. I mean, they have a family tomb. They got to protect it. So they roll a stone in front of it. That's an indicator of some money. And so a rich family like this is going to draw lots of people to a funeral. And by the way, the funeral is going to happen very fast. They don't have the embalming techniques that we have today. So they would have these funerals right away. Word would travel quick. And then the dead would be buried almost immediately. What exactly is Jesus doing here? Jesus is allowing just enough time for Lazarus to die so that everybody can come and see him while he's dead, so that when he is raised from the dead and he's walking down the street, guess what? Yeah, you guessed it. You're not taking anybody's opinion on this. You saw him dead, and now you see for your own eyes that he's alive. And that's why he loves Lazarus 2 days. You know, in the next chapter, John chapter 12, I want to read these verses out of 9 and 10. They explain why Jesus waited. When a large crowd of Jews learned that Jesus was there, they came not only on account of him, but also to see Lazarus. Why did the large crowd of Jewish people go to see Lazarus? Because they were at his funeral. They saw him dead. Now they hear that he's alive, and they can see this with their own eyes. They don't have to take anybody's opinion. We're not talking about some backroom miracle here that nobody really believes happened. It's not like Lazarus died and then immediately Jesus raised him 5 minutes later and you just have to trust me, I saw it take place. Nothing like that. Jesus wants to make this resurrection known to all of Bethany and all of the surrounding area. Thousands upon thousands of people probably came through that funeral line and funeral session and laid eyes upon Lazarus before he went into the tomb. And now as Lazarus walks down the street, they all know that this man, Jesus, who calls himself the Christ, he has the power to raise the dead. Where am I going with this? All the delays that we have in our life are very similar to the delay that God has here with Lazarus. It's intentional. And it's purposeful. And God is anything except indifferent. I heard one man say this. He said, learn to interpret circumstances by the love of Christ, not the love of Christ by circumstances. You know, when you get a delay, it's usually because somebody's indifferent. That's usually why you get a delay. When you're on the phone with Verizon and they say, hang on, and you're on 30 minutes later, they forgot about you. Little secret. They come back and say, oh, they haven't been searching. They forgot about you. We know that, right? When you're on with DirecTV and you're trying to get the Yes Channel, am I too personal here, you know? And you're on hold forever, it's because they forgot about you. Those delays are because of the indifference that people have for each other in this world. And we understand those, right? The delay that Jesus gives here is an intentional, purposeful delay. It's not a delay of indifference. It's a delay of love. It's a delay because God has a purpose in the life of Lazarus and in the life of that entire village. There are times when we ask, where is God? What is God doing in my life? And there appears to be a delay of justice of some kind. We know that all those delays are a result of his love. We should not interpret the love of God through circumstances, but circumstances through the love of God. All right, so that's number one. Number two, Jesus meets the family here. And I love this. The grief of God. Jesus knows our pain, and he's downright angry at suffering in this world. When you read the text, verse 33, Jesus saw her weeping. I want you to listen for the emotions of Jesus. Saw her weeping. The Jews had also come weeping. He, that is Jesus, was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled. Get the superlative language here, right? Deeply moved. Greatly troubled. And then you get the shortest verse in the entire Bible, Jesus wept. Those two words are that's the shortest verse in the entire Bible, Jesus wept. And that word wept, the English word is not really a good translation of that. The Greek word means to yell, means to bellow. Jesus is angry when he shows up and he sees what death has done to this village and what pain and suffering has done to his friend. Jesus here is deeply moved by the pain in the life of Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. Dylan Thomas, the poet, you know, he wrote, rage, rage against the dying of the light. Jesus here is doing something similar. He's not just saying, well, that's the way the cookie crumbles. He's not saying, well, you know, we all live, we all die, that's just the way it goes. Jesus sees death as a parasite on God's good creation. He sees disease as a parasite on God's good creation. And he plans to do something about it. We see the sympathy of Jesus, the sorrow of Jesus, the grief of Jesus. It's a great verse in Hebrews chapter 4 that says, we have a high priest. Christians have a high priest who can sympathize with us in our suffering and in our pain and in our temptations. You know, one of the reasons I'm a Christian, and there are a lot of reasons, but one of the reasons is because the Christian story, it's not God trying to get himself out of the world of suffering, but he puts himself into it. And different things speak to different people. That speaks volumes to me. You know, if you read about the ancient religions, what is it? It's all the gods escape the suffering of this world and go off to something like Mount Olympus. The Christian story is the opposite. God becomes man. In the Christian story, Jesus knows what it's like to be abandoned. Jesus knows what it's like to suffer and feel physical pain. He knows what it's like to have a loved one die like Lazarus. There is nothing that we can go through in this life that Jesus himself hasn't felt. That's why he can sympathize with the pain and the suffering that we have in our lives. You know, Eric Clapton, the songwriter, said this, "Listening to the blues isn't about being sad. It's about rejoicing because someone else knows your pain." I think there's something similar going on here where Jesus knows the pain we're in. And here's where I'm going, congregation. Our God is no ivory tower theologian. He's not a God that's detached from the world and detached from the pain of the world. Jesus drank the native water of this world. He knows what it's like to suffer. There is nothing that you and I could ever go through, no pain we could experience, that Jesus cannot sympathize with us as we go through. Our God is no ivory tower theologian. He's the love of God. He's the grief of God. And guess what? He's the hope of God. The world is broken, and Jesus plans to make it right. And he does here. He gives us a small window, and I'll get to this in a minute, of what he will someday do on a cosmic scale. When Jesus weeps, That's a picture to us that something's broken and something's wrong in the world. All of us have to have hope. We have to have hope. Andrew Del Banco up here in Columbia University in New York City wrote a great book on hope. And one of the things he says in there, in fact, I wrote the quote down for today. Del Banco says, "The real American dream, we must imagine some end to life that transcends our tiny allotment of time." Now listen to what he says. We must imagine. We can't live without hope. We can't live thinking tomorrow's going to be worse than today. There's something in us that wants tomorrow to be better, and our world believes that. But here's the key. The world doesn't usually know why they have hope. In other words, they may have hope and hope. They may have faith and faith, but that's not a real reason to have hope. Our world is a little bit like Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz. You know what I mean? Where she says, "Someday I'll wish upon a star, wake up where the clouds are far behind me. Troubles melt like lemon drops high above the chimney top, that's where you'll find me." You know what that is? That's pure existential hope. It's a wonderful story, Wizard of Oz, but that's pure existential hope. That's Dorothy saying, "I know there's going to be a better tomorrow. I have no idea why there's going to be a better tomorrow. I hope there's a better tomorrow. There's no rational basis. There's no reason to believe there's a better tomorrow, but there's something in her saying, I hope there's a better tomorrow." But in a story like this, we find that not only do Christians have hope, the resurrection is the reason for the hope. It's the basis for the hope. And this is why, as I opened with earlier, where Paul says, Jesus has been raised from the dead, that's the first fruits of those that have fallen asleep. In other words, Jesus being raised from the dead is a small commercial of what God will someday do with people and do with the entire cosmos. It's a sample of what's to come. You know, I just got a new mixer, and I love my new mixer. And Reese, my little daughter, and I, we're over-mixing things. I know this. But it's so much fun to use this mixer. And we made buttercream the other night, you know, and I put my finger in there, and oh, man, it's so good. And I took a little, just a little touch of that buttercream. It was a small sample of the cake to come. The resurrection of Jesus is a small sample of what's to come. The resurrection of Lazarus, small sample of the power that God will someday display. See, we have hope, but it's a real hope. It's not hope and hope. It's not someday I'll wish upon a star. Christians believe because of the power of the resurrection. This summer, we were down in Virginia. Our family was on a vacation, and we went to King's Dominion. I love water parks. I can't do the roller coasters anymore. I told my kids, you get one with me, and then I turn a little bit green, and I can't do any more for the day. So you can turn me green early, or you can turn me green at the end of the day, but you're only getting one. But I'll go on the water rides all day. I love the water rides. And if you've ever been to a real water park, you know what it's like when you feel that first mist? You know what I'm talking about? You're like walking up the stairs to get to the slide, and it's really exciting. You could hear the laughter and the fun. And off the, you know, way up, the wind is blowing maybe, and a little bit of mist kind of hits you, and it's so refreshing on a warm day, that cool spray. That mist is a small sample of what's to come when you get all the way up. The resurrection of Lazarus and the resurrection of Jesus, it's the mist of the kingdom. It's the mist of the new creation. In fact, all the miracles of Jesus are like this. You know, when Jesus changes water into wine, what is that? That's the mist of the kingdom. What does it mean when he heals a withered hand? It means someday he's going to heal the creation. He's going to heal people. What does it mean when he calms the winds and the waves? That's the mist of the kingdom. The resurrection of Lazarus shows us there is hope to come. We Christians, we join the world in hoping for a better tomorrow, but we have a solid foundation. We have a foundation of the resurrection. We believe not just because we want to believe. We believe because Jesus was raised from the dead. The last point is this, the sacrifice of God. Jesus died a horrible death so we could live a glorious life. And in this passage, Jesus shows himself to be the sacrifice of God. Let me read to you a couple of verses. Listen for these. Verse 50 through 53, same passage. The high priest says this. The high priest gets very upset that Lazarus has been raised from the dead. And this is kind of ironic. The high priest says, now we're going to find Lazarus and put him to death a second time. Ooh, you know, raise him once, I can raise him twice. But, you know, they're in a fury. And the high priest says this as they're going to go after Jesus. Nor do you understand that it is better for one man that he should die for the people than the whole nation perish. He did not say this of his own accord, John says, but being the high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation. Now, this is important. The high priest is speaking off the cuff here. He's an antagonist in the story. And the high priest says that Jesus, it's better off that Jesus goes to the cross than we lose our entire nation. And John says he's speaking there more than he knows, because Jesus is going to go to the cross. He is going to die for the nation, but he's going to do it in the way the high priest could never imagine. One of the things you find in this passage is the same thing you find in the book of John. And for you that read the book of John, read it through this way sometime. There's something in the book of John that when you see it, you'll see it everywhere, but you probably won't see it until it's pointed out. You know how like when September comes, it's the end of September, and you're riding with a friend, and your friend says, oh, look at the trees. There's, you know, orange and red, it's beautiful. And you're like, oh yeah, yes, yeah, look at it. And then you see it everywhere. Here's something in the book of John that when you see it once, you'll just see it throughout John. Every time Jesus reaches out to help somebody in the book of John, he's taking a great risk to himself. Every time he reaches out, it's a sacrifice that he has to make, sometimes small, sometimes big. When Jesus goes to the woman at the well and reaches out to the woman at the well, he receives her with great risk of he himself being shamed because he reached out to her. In John 5, when he heals somebody on the Sabbath, he's healing at risk to himself. In John 9, he heals on the Sabbath again. It's great risk to himself. Every time Jesus heals somebody, somebody wants to take his life or somebody wants to shame him. That's a theme that's all over the book of John. And here you really see it in John chapter 11, because when Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead, it's at that point that they want to go take his life. And a high priest says, let's take his life and let's spare the nation. And this is a picture of what Jesus did for us on the cross. Jesus, in essence, raises Lazarus from the dead, but it's that very act that is going to lead him to the cross where he'll have his own death. Christ is willing to make a sacrifice to reach out to the world. So I want to close with one thought on the sacrifice of God, and it's this. At the heart of Christianity, and if you leave here and you remember nothing else, just remember one word. At the heart of Christianity is the word exchange, because that's the heart of the gospel. Jesus exchanges his life for his people's. He died on a cross, so we don't have to die that horrible spiritual death. At the heart of Christianity is an exchange. Jesus' life for mine, Jesus' life for yours, for those that believe in him. It's a wonderful picture of exchange in Charles Dickens' Tale of Two Cities. You that know the story there, Sidney Carton, he dies for Charles Darnay. The young Frenchman, Darnay, he's got a wife and children, and he's condemned to die by the guillotine. And there's Sidney Carton, the fast-living English lawyer, wasted his gifts and his talents on riotous living. And he hears about the plight of his friend, and he determines to save him. And so what does the lawyer Sidney Carton do? He gains admission to the dungeon where his friend is being held. On the way down to the dungeon or up to the dungeon, he looks and he can see light come out of a window. That's where the daughter is staying, and so it urges him on. He slips into the dungeon. He exchanges garments with the man that's condemned to die. The next day, he's let out and he's put to death in the place of his friend, Charles Darnay. Another author says this, not Dickens, someone else writing about the story says, as we see him ascending the steps to the place of death with his hands bound behind his back, taking his last look at the world, we feel that a noble ending has sanctified an ignoble life. And these words of our Savior come to mind. Greater love has no man than this, than a man laid down his life for his friends. And in a much greater way, congregation, the Son of God is led to the cross so we might go free. It cost Jesus something to raise Lazarus from the dead. It ultimately would cost him his life. And that's a picture of the gospel. It's a picture of the cross. Exchange. The gospel is the great exchange, the greatest deal in human history. Where my sin goes on Jesus, he pays for it at the cross, and his righteousness is given to my account, so I stand before God complete. So we have a lot of pain in this world, don't we? Let's remember these 4 points. Number one, Jesus is the love of God. He's not indifferent. Number two, he is the grief of God. He weeps with those that weep. Number three, he's the hope of God. He is the mist of the kingdom. His resurrection is someday all the wrongs will be made right. He is the sacrifice of God, willing to give it all to make sure that happens.